This show is a part of the FM Podcast Network, the home of great music podcasts. Visit us at fmpods.com.
You are listening to the Dilettantes Podcast.
Hey everyone, it's Jim Salvucci from the Dilettantes. A novelist and author of many short stories, today's guest, John Vedasta, teaches high school English near Boston, Massachusetts. Under both a pseudonym and his real name, his fiction has appeared in many magazines, including Yellow Mama, Alfred Hitchcock Mystery Magazine, Wild Side, Black Cat, and Tough Crime. A veteran of more than 50 Bob Dylan concerts, he is the co-author with Keith Nambe of Bob Dylan in Performance, Song, Stage, and Screen, as well as other Dylan and Woody Guthrie articles. So, John, welcome to the Dilettantes.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited.
Yeah, we're excited to have you here. So tell me, what is it about Bob Dylan?
What is it about Bob Dylan? Everyone asks me that because nobody understands my obsession with Bob Dylan. But I've loved Dylan since high school. So I think what it is about him is that he is absolutely unique. Nobody sounds like him. Nobody writes like him. And yet, at the same time, he is like so many other people. There are so many intersections where Dylan is singing the blues, Dylan is singing gospel, Dylan is singing American standards. I have learned so much about music and literature and history from my obsession with Bob Dylan, and it just keeps going deeper and deeper all the time. Yes, he is unique by being like everyone else.
And how do other people react when you said you have a hard time explaining it, but how do they react when they find out how big you are into Dylan?
It's the constant, oh, I like his music, but or his words, but by other people. Why can't he sound like Peter, Paul, and Mary? And I said, because that's not him. Like, he's the whole package. I've tried listening to covers, and a lot of them are nice. And people say, oh, you have to get this new album of Dylan covers. But nothing ever hooks in with those. It's the performance as well. When I was in college, I had Christopher Ricks as the professor, and he taught me how to write. And he would always talk about how Dylan was about performance, how that one time he did Hattie Carroll was perfect, and he never should have done it again, ever, and changed it, because that performance actually solidified the words. So for people to say to me, oh, I would rather listen to Dylan by way of someone else, it's okay. Do you really want to see an Alfred Hitchcock movie made by somebody else? You don't. That's what you're there to see.
You don't want to see the remake of Psycho?
No, absolutely not.
Yeah, I got to meet Christopher Ricks in France at my first Dylan conference. It was he's an interesting guy. He really is dedicated, really was happy to help other people. He's a nice guy.
He is just so kind. When Keith Nambe and I both had him, we were roommates at BU, Boston University. And Keith lives in California. And when our book came out, I was the one who got to give him a copy. And, you know, we thank him there. And so much of our writing is influenced by Christopher Ricks. And I went into his office and we talked about things. I told him about a fight he and I had, not a fight, but a disagreement on Dylan, an interpretation we had. And he looked at me and he says, opposition is friendship. And then he asked me, and this was so Christopher Ricks, which of my books do you not have? It just was sort of, which of my books do you not have? I love that book. And then he gave me a book on poets who argued with each other, almost rap battles or something like that.
So answer poetry, yeah.
Yes.
I love it.
But it was a chance. Actually, the disagreement we had, you know, way back in college, I was thinking that in Lily Rosemary and the Jack of Hearts, I had this idea that Diamond Jim was actually Lily's father. And I had all these different examples, and I told him this, and he just looked at me and said, no. But when I give him the book 30 years later, I was able to say, hey, it was my book, and I put that in there. He loved that.
That's great. So tell me about your Bob Dylan origin story. How did you first get into Bob?
In the 80s, I was totally into pop I was a techno pop guy. I loved Duran, OMD, Men at Work, all of that stuff. And it was.
Did you have an accident? Is this going to involve an accident?
No, there will actually be okay. No.
Because there's a big change here coming.
But then We Are the World came up. And I'm watching that to see all my guys, Huey Lewis or something like that. And then there's this one guy. And I said to my father, who is that old homeless looking guy? And he gave me his copy, his mono copy of Highway 61. And that was it. I was totally on board with Dylan from there on out. And it was also good because when high school, you're looking for your own identity, you're looking for who you are, what makes you stand out. And Dylan really made me different from everyone else in high school. It was a really big help to stake my own identity. This is who I am. I also, growing up in New England, I learned to like Moxie. So listening to Dylan, drinking Moxie, which I don't know where you live, but Moxie is like a combination of root beer and NyQuil. And only a diehard New Englanders can drink it. That really made me who I was. I've stuck with him all the way through. My first Dylan show was with Tom Petty in 86. And I'm still kicking myself to this day that I didn't get to see him with the Grateful Dead in 87. Mm. I think that's the only time he's come to the Boston area since then that I've missed him.
Wow. That's an impressive run there. Tell us a little bit more about yourself. What are some of your other interests? You're a writer, you're a high school teacher. What else are you interested in? Just so people get to know you.
I love my writing. I'm actually a very shy, solitary person. Despite, I don't know how I got married. Actually, my wife's a bookseller. So that's, we're all about books in the house. So I love to read and write mysteries. And some of them are actually Dylan related, not like based on Dylan, but I always get a Dylan line or two in there somehow. And I don't know what else about myself. That's pretty much it. I go to work and I teach kids how to read and write. And then I come home to relax, like read and write and listen to Dylan as much as I can, which isn't so much in the house. I am the only Dylan fan in the house. So sometimes I have to sneak it in as a secret smoker or something like that.
For those of you who aren't seeing this on video, behind John is a bookcase crammed with books and looks like CDs.
Yeah, and actually, yeah, what's there is just the books. No, these are all way down there. And that's just one of five bookcases that's in this room.
Okay. And you can tell it's an active bookcase. I want to talk a little bit about your writing. What about your work as a novelist, a short story writer? What do you write about?
Being such a shy guy, I actually write about everything that I can't do. A lot of my fiction is crime fiction, and a lot of it is from the point of view of the criminals. As a teacher, I like to try to get to understand people, get to know them. And so what fascinates me is how people can get away with doing such outrageous things. I don't even really jaywalk, which is unusual in Boston. Mm-hmm. But by writing my fiction, I get to actually try to see what it's like to be a person who breaks the rules, who isn't bound by convention, who does the outrageous thing that I would never contemplate doing myself. So it's actually led me into some pretty dark places. A lot of my fiction is really, it's not gory, but it is definitely dark. It is transgressive. Let's put it this way. When I had been married for 13 years, my first novel came out, and my sister-in-law said, who did my sister marry? Right. I'm like, it's me. But I really enjoy just exploring the underside of what people do. And I'm also a romantic, so I also like to write about bygone times. Most of my books take place even before I was born, in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, long before I was around. That's why I actually enjoy, unlike a lot of my friends who do Dylan, I love the American Songbook albums. I think they're fabulous. And I think part of it is that I have this romantic idea of a time that I never even lived in.
But there's got to be more to it than that. What else attracts you to those albums?
To those albums? Part of it is I didn't actually know most of those songs. Mm. And so a lot of listening to Dylan has taught me about things that I never even heard of. So there are the old songs. One thing that it's led me to is just studying a lot of connections that I didn't know were there. One was, as a teacher, I creative writing, I'm always looking for poetry forms to teach my students, things like that, short things that they can do in a class period or something like that. And I found it in an anthology, it's very easy to say, a poem form called the Rubai or the Rubaiyat. You might have heard of the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. Used to be the most famous poem in the world. And it was originally written in the 10th century by a Persian writer, Omar Khayyam. And the poems are just these four line quatrains. And so I was teaching some of the most famous ones out of my textbook. And then all of a sudden Tempest comes out and I'm listening to it. I'm like, I know that line. That's in a poem that I taught. And I started looking through Tempest and I realized that he has over and over again references to this poem that inspired T.S. Eliot to become a poet at all. He read it when he was 14. He's, I have to be a poet. And so I started going through it and I realized, oh, Dylan's using all of this Omar Khayyam stuff. And so I studied that and I actually got to go down to Tulsa at World of Bob Dylan and present on that. But while I was there, I got to go to the Woody Guthrie archive. And it turns out that Woody Guthrie had completely rewritten the Rubaiyat in his own Guthrie way and recorded it. And nobody else had ever heard it. And I got to listen to this, not at the archive, but from Smithsonian. They listened to it. And I got to study Woody Guthrie's use of the Rubaiyat. And so I just keep going down all these different pathways. Woody's version is really different. What he did was he took this poem that's all about the idea of, it's all carpe diem poetry. And what the English translator Fitzgerald did was he shaped it into a plot where this very conventional man starts getting very interested in wine and starting to question the world around him. In 10th century Persian, he would have been a Muslim, so he's got to keep the drinking part on the DL. Nobody even knew he was a poet until he had been dead for 50 years. And it was that poetry that kind of led Fitzgerald, who was probably a closeted gay man, to be able to express himself with this poetic mass, which is what attracted T.S. Eliot. Oh, this great poem is about a man with a poetic mask. I have one. And then suddenly Woody Guthrie is putting on that same mask. Woody Guthrie is quoting one of his songs in Pastures of Plenty when he talks about people who come with the dust and are gone with the wind, which is the line that Dylan quotes in Song to Woody. And it's just this chain, this thousand-year chain absolutely fascinates me. Yeah. And I got that because I was teaching a four-line poem to a bunch of ninth graders. And that's the thing about Bob Dylan. Like, you just follow all of these threads and they go everywhere.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Fitzgerald, I believe that's the same Fitzgerald who was a translator of the Iliad and the Odyssey as well.
Nope, it's a different one.
Actually. A different one, okay.
A different one. And I actually teach the Fitzgerald Odyssey.
That, you know, oh, do you? Right, okay.
There, you're pointing is like my Odyssey shelf.
Okay. Oh, yeah. I see Odyssey. The Iliad there, I think.
Yeah. The Odyssey. Probably my favorite book, actually.
The Odyssey?
The Odyssey. And Dylan's quoting that all through the Tempest, too. But that's more of Richard Thompson's area. So I'm going to let him have that. And now I'm confusing him. Robert Fitzgerald's translated the Odyssey. And looking behind me, I can't remember. Written so much, but yeah, different Fitzgeralds.
Okay. I do have to clarify one thing. When you say Tempest is one of the very few Bob Dylan albums that has a title track. And when you're saying throughout Tempest, do you mean the album or the song?
The album, although the song does have several Omar Khayyam references, like Loveliest and the Best comes from him. But I am actually, most of them are in like Narrow Way. He quotes the line about the moving finger writes and continues on. I don't know the exact line of either of them, but I have it somewhere over here. What is the line from Narrow Way? But he talks about, I saw you buried and I saw you dug up. And he talks about the moving finger is moving on. And the line, be gentle, brother, be gentle and pray. All of those are Omar Khayyam. Okay. So he just kept popping up and popping up. But he does it actually throughout his career. He was doing it maybe accidentally on Song to Woody. And one day I was driving to school and I had Absolutely Sweet Marie on, and I heard about the drunken Persian. I'm like, that's him. So again and again, keeps popping up, but mostly on the album. Yeah.
I interviewed Scott Warmoth a couple months ago, and he's the master of these connections. And it's just fascinating to contemplate this stuff, just these intertexts, these references, tying in with other musical artists, tying in with literary artists. And it's just a fascinating thing to really contemplate the depth of Dylan's literary form. We argue about whether he deserved a Nobel Prize in literature. Does he create literature? He argued maybe not, but it's hard to separate it. It really is hard to separate his lyrics from literature.
I absolutely think that it is literature. What he does is he takes everything in. We've always talked about the musical connections, but he takes in so many literary ones and then makes them his own. Can't separate the words from the voice, from the music. It's all of a piece.
Let's talk a little bit about the book you co-authored with Keith Nambe, Performance, mm-hmm. Song, Stage, and Screen. I interviewed Keith quite a while ago, and so if listeners might want to go back and check that out. I should have the date at my fingertips, but I don't. What inspired you to write about Dylan as a performer?
It started out, it was Keith's idea. Keith and I had been friends way back in college, and he moved to the opposite coast, but he was in town giving a paper on Dylan. So I met him afterwards, and it turns out that he had been offered, based on his presentation, a book deal, which he said yes to. And then he came and said, I've never written a full book before. You want to write with me? And I said, I write crime novels. It's completely different. I haven't written an academic paper, a little or a book, since college, since grad school. He encouraged me to do it. And we just had so much fun together. We're such good friends anyhow. But writing together just, I think, brought us together quite a bit. We've written several other things since then. And we're doing something now. And it's just such a fun process. And if you read the book, you'll notice that they alternate. We didn't do this on purpose. But mostly he has the odd number chapters. I have the even of chapters. We wrote everything together, but the spark of each particular chapter came from one or the other. And you can see that I focus a lot more on the literature. He focuses a lot more on the performative ideas. And I think the two of them come together really nicely. And since we both had Christopher Ricks, we're both deeply influenced by him. I can't go back and say he wrote that sentence or I wrote that sentence. I think it blends really well. It was such a fun idea to do. And we didn't have any kind of an assignment. So we could really just follow every rabbit hole we wanted to follow. And both of us found lots of rabbit holes. It was just a great experience. And yeah, it was just so much fun.
If you don't mind my asking, or you don't mind sharing, what are you working on now with Keith?
Aaron Callahan and Cork Carney are doing an 80s mm-hmm. Dylan book. And so that's what we're working on.
Ah, okay.
Our particular topic is that we think 80s Dylan was starting his archive then. I've never disliked the 80s because that was my entry point. But our basic attitude is at that point, he was the middle-aged rocker. There were a lot of middle-aged rockers then, but they were breaking ground then. You didn't generally have middle-aged rockers before that. And they were like, what do we do at this point in our career? And Dylan, again, was at the forefront. He put out Biograph, which was like an archive. And I think that a lot of the studio albums were more like looking back at his influences, taking stock, cleaning out the attic, so to speak. And it may not have been super original, but it was a way of kind of gathering strength, seeing what he had. Everyone said he was a has-been. He was even in the introductions. He was a has-been in the 80s. And yet, boom, you suddenly get, after the acoustic albums in the 90s, you get Time Out of Mind, and then everything this century, which I actually listen to more than anything else. But I think all of that was, he got to the 80s and needed to figure out what he had.
Yeah.
So yeah. That's what we're working on now. It's coming along really well. We've come at it from two completely different directions, and it's mixing up really nicely.
You contributed a chapter to their previous book on set lists too.
Yes. We were looking at two different shows, one in 64 and the one in 66 on the world tour with the band. And our argument in that one was, a lot of people looked at 64 as, you know, the old Dylan stuck in the folk world. But we're arguing that he was already making that separation then, that he was already changing songs, and his choice of songs were pushing away that old folky idea. It turns out the one song that is common to both of those shows plus Newport was Mr. Tambourine Man. So we look at how Mr. Tambourine Man is the pivot point that links that whole time period.
You've seen Dylan more than 50 times.
Yeah,
over
which
decades.
Now I'm finding out isn't quite so impressive compared to some of the other people. But yeah.
I interviewed someone who had seen him over 300 times. So.
Wow.
And I've seen him a little more than half of the time, you know, the number of times you've seen him. But so you've seen him many times. You've over decades. You have co-written a book on performance. What stands out in all those performances?
Different things at different times. When he was with Tom Petty, the first time I saw him, he says in his chronicles, that was his low point, that he was ready to give up. But what I found was, I didn't know this at the time, but looking back on it, it was such an exciting show. And it's still the best performance of Knocking on Heaven's Door that I've ever heard. And that amazing harmonica solo that you can hear in the Hard to Handle video on HBO. It was just such a great show. And now that I know that he was at his low point, to think that he was such a professional, he's so good at his job that even not caring, not feeling it himself, he could give to his audience. Such an amazing show. I saw him at one of his absolute worst shows ever. That would have been in 91. I read on, I think it was on Ray Padgett's blog, that the worst show was like 5 shows after that in Europe, rock bottom. But he keeps coming back, like nothing stops him. That's what I keep taking away from it. And in his later shows, I find that he's really sharing all of this knowledge that he's taken. He really is like Homer, like Shakespeare, a person who conveys and passes on as much of the culture as he can. So I remember going to one show in maybe 2018. It was with Mavis Staples. Mm-hmm. That was a fun show. Mm-hmm. And we're at Boston University. And it was just such a good show where he was showing off his Sinatra songs, his connection with Mavis Staples. And it was, what song? It was something off of Modern Times. Maybe... oh, now I can't even think of the song off the top of my head. The opening track.
Of what, Modern Times?
Of Modern Times.
Thunder on the Mountain.
Thunder on the Mountain. Oh, my goodness. But it has that great drum solo in it. And we're mm-hmm. listening to it. And it was the drum solo from Wipeout.
Wow.
You know, and it was like in this one song, you're getting this whole history of music. And people were walking out because it wasn't what they, you know, wanted from 1974 or something like that. And my friend Matt and I were just in awe. Like, this is a masterclass on the history of American music. And people are walking out. But most of the levers were gone by maybe 2/3 of the way through the show. And then that last third for the true believers, he was just outrageously good. And so every time we see him, it's like we're learning some history of music. Around the same time, I saw Paul Simon with my wife and son for his farewell tour. And it was a beautiful concert. He sounded exactly like he always did. And he set the show up like a history of American music as done by him throughout his career. And it was really nice. And it was really sweet. And he explained things through the talk. But seeing Dylan do the same thing in his Dylan-esque way without talking to the audience, just letting the music do the talking, that was the thing that I really held on to. I enjoyed the Paul Simon concert, but I lived for the Dylan shows. And his voice is better now than ever. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've seen him when he was really bad. Mm-hmm. You know, I saw him one time where it was like Vandals, Handles, and like he was just gone. He thought he was never going to come back, but he's better than ever. He's grown into that voice that he was faking on the first album.
And what do you think that is? Why do you think he's gotten better? Because I agree, but why do you think that is?
I think he knows how to write for his voice. Hmm. I think before he was trying to match his voice to the words. He was putting on the fake oaky accent. He was putting on fake old black bluesman voices. It was all trying to be somebody else. Now he's just being himself. And I think with the new arrangements to songs to match what he's able to do, he knows what he can do. He knows what he can't do. And he's not trying. So he doesn't have anything proved anymore, right? He's just going out there and showing what he's got. And those of us who are lucky enough to go along, we're just in awe of him.
Yeah. Yeah. He has nothing to prove. I used to joke around after he won the Pulitzer Prize. I said, all he's got left is the Nobel Prize and the Heisman Trophy. I don't think he's going to get the Heisman. But he pretty much got all the others. I always like to ask people what other music they listen to. And you used to listen to Duran.
And I still do once in a while.
Okay.
I still go back to my 80s pop. But I listen to a lot of Tom Petty now, a lot of Woody Guthrie. I'm still all in that American basic rock kind of area. Being from Boston, I like a little bit of Aerosmith, things like that. But Dylan probably makes up about 80%, maybe even 90% of what I listen to. But I love to go back to the 80s quite a bit. We had some really great local bands here. There was a band called O Positive. They had almost the national hit with Up, Up, Up. We had Billy Squire. We sang The Stroke and Rock Me Tonight. So we had a lot of great 80s stuff here in Boston. So I listen to those too.
And is there any connection in that music to Dylan at all, or is it just separate?
A lot of it is straight up guitar, rock, guitar, bass, rock and roll. A lot of garage bands sounds. So again, that goes back to like the early 80s. Knocked Out Loaded is actually one of my favorite sounding records. There are a lot of corners on the record, but the sound that he had for Knocked Out Loaded is probably my favorite. And it's just that loose guitar, the drums, and not much else. No real mixing. It sounds like he's playing in a garage and playing in the nastiest dive you've ever been in. So I think that's the connection there. He's taught me to actually start listening to a lot of classic country. You know, for the longest time, I'm like, I don't like country, but I saw him on the Outlaws tour. I've seen him a couple of times with Willie Nelson, although Willie didn't play at the show that I saw. But getting into that classic rock and roll country music, old Johnny Cash. I love Kris Kristofferson. I totally have memorized his first album. It all flows back to the Dylan's brand of rock and roll.
You mentioned Knocked Out Loaded and the sound. So that I have to ask, what do you think about the sound on Empire Burlesque?
I like it. But it's definitely dated. I think it works for that particular album. I don't think the songs he was writing would work with a Knocked Out Loaded kind of sound, although I'd always love to hear Dylan try it. I like to listen to Empire Burlesque, but I can only listen to it maybe once every few months.
Yeah.
It's not bad, but it's a little too superficial, I think. And that was the problem with all of the 80s synthesizer music. It just didn't go deep. And I liked it when I was a teenager. But yeah, it's a little too slick, I think. But the lyrics on there, oh my God, the lyrics. People have always pointed out that, oh, it's just all movie quotes. But I think, again, that's part of the archiving that he was doing. Michael Grace was, oh, he's just old and watching the late night show. But there's no way that he could actually quote so well and so much if he was just like this tired old guy. Like, he had to be like cribbing all of those lines. And that's what I'd love to do. I would love to go and investigate. I've looked at copies. It's been in Mixer and FMS and things like his lyrics. But he never makes notes about, this is from Maltese Falcon, or this is from the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. But he's got that stuff in his head. So I would love to find something where he's writing down what he's listening to, what he's watching, what he's reading. Although I saw that Axie posted one of his favorite books today. It was somebody posted, or he posted that it was, he wanted to track down some publisher because they published his favorite book or a book that he loved, something about the great god Pan. I don't remember. I just saw it on Expecting Rain this morning.
I saw something about that. I didn't get to investigate it. So that was from what, a tweet that he did?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I would love to get a book list of his. Just, yeah. What do you read?
I think you have to get your hands on that box that he talks about. You got to get into that thing. Yeah, I find the pastiche methodology that he uses amazing. And I'm always a little irked when people are dismissive of it as though it's not a thing in and of itself. First of all, it's conceptual art. It is a form of art. And he does it throughout his art. What are we going to poo-poo Matisse when he started doing collages? Or when I was in the 80s, I saw the great tenor saxophonist, Sonny Rollins, and he was doing this series where he would improvise quoting other songs, just playing other songs and making them work together. So you play a line from this song and a line from that song and a line from another song. And it wasn't planned. And in fact, it was in Philadelphia and a siren went by, a police car, and he started imitating the siren and made it work in the improvisation.
And he put it
right. I always see Dylan, that's what he's doing, right? That's exactly what he's doing. This is not easy. It's not easy.
Right.
Yeah.
He's not just making a found poem with random lines.
Right.
What Richard Thomas points out is that on the album Tempest, he quotes extensively from the Odyssey, but it's a certain translation. It's the Fagles translation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only lines spoken by the mature Odysseus. So it's not just random lines, it's only that. And on Empire Burlesque, it's almost always lines about individualism from film noir. It's not just cool random lines. It's about the individual. It's about that person who has to stand up and handle something on his own. Yeah, there's nothing to dismiss. There's a lot going on there.
John, this has been absolutely fabulous. I really enjoyed this. Where can people find you online?
Online, they can find me on Facebook. I am on X, but I don't really do anything on there. So I think Facebook is the place to look. If they want to read some crime fiction, they can go to jntaylorcrimewriter.com.
Is that your pseudonym?
I just doubted myself. I have that so my students don't read my stuff, but I'm pretty sure my students are going to watch this podcast. Sorry.
Oh, boy. Wow, you just opened a can of worms there.
Yeah, I did.
John, thank you so much for being on the Dilettantes.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a great time. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Dilettantes podcast. Be sure to subscribe to have the Dilettantes sent directly to your inbox. And share the Dilettantes on social media.